I'm a habitual avoider. Let me explain. It's been almost 8 years. And I still, as someone who is a writer and a learner of and an expert in words, don't know how to put words to the way it felt when I sat down in my doctor's office. I'd had 3 miscarriages at this point, 1.5 years trying to conceive, a miscarriage that I learned about at my first ultrasound, and I had to have surgery to terminate. Another that was spontaneous, and another that was an ectopic pregnancy. And when I found out I was pregnant for the 3rd time, after the 2 miscarriages, I had a lot of things going for me in terms of healthcare that many women aren't fortunate enough to have. I live in a large city. I have good health insurance. I have the privilege of the color of my skin. And more than anything, I had an exceedingly empathetic gynecologist who also happened to be married to one of the top reproductive specialists in Atlanta. So traditionally, before you can go in for recurrent miscarriage testing, you have to have had 3 miscarriages with no full-term pregnancies and living births. And that's changed recently, and now it's 2, as I believe it always should have been. But my gynecologist knew after 2, this is not normal. And she was working on the paperwork to get me referred over to her husband's clinic. Typically, after my first miscarriage, it took 6 to 8 weeks before I got my period back. And so after the 2nd one, I was expecting the same thing. And our plan was that we would start that process once I had my next period, because in these reproductive doctor's offices, they need you to get to certain points in your cycles for them to be able to do different types of tests. So we were doing blood work to follow my HCG levels, the pregnancy hormone, all the way down to 0. And once they got there, we were going to start some of that process. And I was at work, and I was actually in work in the office with my office mate, who I've talked about earlier in this season because she was so supportive during my losses, especially because she was pregnant during them. And I get a phone call from my gynecologist, and I answer it fully expecting to hear, "Great news. Your levels are at 0. You can now go to the fertility clinic. Here's the next steps." Then I hear my doctor's voice. And if you've been through anything fertility related, you don't want to hear your doctor's voice on the phone. You want to hear the nurse. The nurses deliver the good news. And my doctor said, "So, have you had sex since your last loss?" And I said, "I mean, once, but we were careful." And she said, "Not careful enough, you're pregnant." And I broke down. As someone who had been trying for 2 years to have a baby, I was so devastated at the news that I was pregnant, because all that meant to me was loss. And we hadn't done the testing yet, and I knew there was never a part of me that believed that this was a viable pregnancy. And she said, "I need you to come in now, like right now, leave work. We're going to do more blood work. We've got to figure out what's going on." And then she asked my permission, "May I consult with my husband about your case and find out what we can do to see if there's anything we can do to try to save this pregnancy?" And I said, "Of course." And then Rebecca, my office mate, and I were like repeating as a mantra, "It was a lab error. It was a lab error. The next one's going to come back at 0. It wasn't a lab error. And so that day, I went to have blood drawn to find out if it was a lab error. And they took 20 vials of blood to run all of the different tests to see if it was possible to pinpoint anything that they could do anything about at that point. And the reality that I didn't really understand at the time was that the answer was going to be no, because most of the things that they're able to find and treat are things that you start treating at ovulation or even earlier. You don't just start treating at conception. Some things are, but very few. 2 days later, I'm in the same office, the same person. My phone rings again, and she shuts the door, and she puts her arm on me, and she's like, all right, let's do this. Let's see what's going on. And I answer the phone, and my doctor says, you need to go to the emergency room. I think your pregnancy is ectopic. And so John and I spend that night in the emergency room. I got a methotrexate injection, which is something that's used for chemotherapy. And it literally dissolved what was growing in my fallopian tube that would have become a baby had it been in the right part of my uterus. And shortly thereafter, I hadn't even gone back to work yet. They got the results for the testing. And so I went into my doctor's office, and I was really excited about this. There's this very strange thing that happens when you're going through infertility or recurrent pregnancy loss, where you just desperately want them to find a problem, because a problem means a solution.
Yeah.
And there's only a 50% chance they're going to find one. So, but I didn't even know that yet then. So I went in to this appointment nervous, but also pretty excited, because I thought, this is it. This is where I'm going to find out what's happening. And then she's going to send me to her husband, and he's going to fix it.
This is after the ectopic pregnancy.
Like just a few short days after the ectopic pregnancy. Like I hadn't even returned to work. So I had just had my third loss. The ectopic one, I will say, emotionally was easier for me. Because I never once allowed myself to believe that that could be a viable pregnancy. The emergency room was a little traumatic, but other than that. So I walked into the office, and the doctor came in shortly behind me, and she had this giant stack of paperwork, because obviously we had lab tests to go through from 20 plus vials of blood. And one of the ways in which I'm lucky, and a lot of women are not, is that my doctor has a very good emotional IQ. And so she sat down, and she had the paper kind of turned over in her lap so I couldn't see it. And she was like, all right, we're going to go over the results of your test. We're going to go through each one, one by one, because I know you like to understand exactly what's happening. But before I show them to you, I just need you to understand that medical language can be really cruel, and I don't have the ability to work outside of it. I have to code certain things into your chart so that your insurance will cover the testing and will cover transitioning over to a specialist. And unfortunately, you're going to see that, and it's going to be really hard, and I just want you to know that I acknowledge that.
Wow, she's good.
She's amazing. And she flipped the paper back over. And not even on the paper. At the very, very top, in giant, bold letters of my super thick medical chart, it said, habitual aborter. And I had so many things going for me in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
I had an empathetic doctor who had given me warning. I had a degree that lent me to the study of words and language. And from that, because of the women's bodies I studied, the knowledge of the fact that abortion is the word for miscarriage used in different situations for different types of loss. And even still, I don't know the words. I'm a writer, and I don't know the words. 8 years later. And what this led me to realize was this drastic chasm that exists between the way that we talk about women's bodies and women's lived experiences, and the way that we have taken a medical term, abortion, and we have placed politics and ideology and religious and moral values on top of it, and we have conflated these phrases, does tremendous emotional harm to women who are going through this type of loss. And I've talked about this a lot over the years. I've written about it a lot. Talking about it's a lot harder. And I have posted on Instagram variations of this story multiple times. And I have like a picture of me holding this handwritten sign that says, "Four wanted pregnancies lost," and then another one that says, "I'm a habitual aborter." And I have shared variations of this over the years, and every time I put it on Instagram, it goes viral. And every time I start getting notifications that I've been tagged in reposts and reusages, and I look at them, and I discover that my story and my pain is being co-opted by both sides of this debate. And no one is asking, how do you feel? They're assuming I feel the way they feel. Mm-hmm. And they're using this viral post to bring awareness to their political cause, which is exactly what caused the problem that made me feel so hurt and angered in the first place. Because what people don't understand is that abortion was a medical term first, and for centuries before it was used in the context that we regularly know it today. People will correct me on these posts, and they'll say, no, you're wrong. The medical word for miscarriage is an abortion. It's spontaneous abortion. That is true. If you spontaneously lose your pregnancy and you start bleeding and cramping and you have a miscarriage, you have experienced a spontaneous abortion before the age of 20 weeks. If you experience what I experienced with my first pregnancy, where I found out in an ultrasound that my baby was no longer living, despite the fact that I was still hovered around a toilet with morning sickness and all the pregnancy symptoms, you have experienced a missed abortion. If you are bleeding and cramping, but your baby still has a heartbeat, or if your baby's heartbeat is slower than it's supposed to be for the gestational age, or perhaps they're growing slower than they're supposed to be, then you are diagnosed with a threatened abortion. This might be something that happens. We need to keep a close eye on you. This is the medical language. And yet, right now, at the time of recording this episode, there are two conflicting, trending hashtags on TikTok. Hashtag abortion is medical care, and hashtag abortion is not medical care. And both of these hashtags, in many, not all cases, are being used to serve up ideological beliefs, to blame and shame women on either side of the fence and all the places in the middle, without good, in most situations, in most cases, without good, accurate context into the ways in which abortion is literally healthcare. Because it's on my chart, and I have never terminated a pregnancy. It was too hard for me to even get there for that to ever be a consideration. And so I really want to talk about just this word, one episode for this word alone. And I have a request for the listener. as we go into this. I would really love it if just for the next 20 minutes or so, you can set aside everything you know about the word abortion so we can just talk about the word, its history, how it has transformed, and the chasm that it is creating in our society that we have to get past if we want to stop hating each other, stop hurting each other, stop ridiculing each other, and stop using complete misunderstandings of language to dictate the jobs that doctors are able to do when they're best informed. Mm-hmm. I just want to talk about we are experts in words. We are experts in language. And I want to talk about this word. What does it mean? Where does it come from? How has that meaning shifted and become so politicized, so ideologized? Is that a word? It should, it's not, but it should be. Become something that has so much ideology and morality and judgment around it. I really want to talk about that. So we've done a lot of research. So we're going to use our notes for this article to make sure that we're keeping to the course of accurate information for you from all of the research that we've done. And then in the end, we're going to talk about what we can do about it.
And on that note, too, we just want to say that if you're looking for those hashtags, it's abortion is healthcare and abortion is not healthcare.
Yes. And I don't know if they'll still be trending by the time this episode is released. But quite frankly, we're in an election year, so they probably will be.
Yeah.
So, and there will be a lot more things that have been said by this point. And we really want you to just put those things aside for a minute and say, I'm here to listen. Look, everyone has an opinion on this. Our goal in this episode is not to force an opinion onto you. It is not to convert you to any belief. It's simply to say, look, we're attributing completely different meanings to the same word in a way that is causing a lot of problems. And let's understand that word and figure out steps toward solutions so that we don't have to be so divided. So let's talk about the history, the evolution of this word, because it's important. And I think we really need to understand that in order to understand how we're impacting women through conflating these different ideas on these words. So historically, I know a lesson. We love a lesson. All right. So historically, etymologically, which we told you last time, you know, just means the history of a word. Etymologically, in its history, all that the word abortion meant was the expulsion or removal from the womb of a developing embryo or fetus in the period before it is capable of independent survival. That specifically can mean occurring as a result of either natural causes or as a deliberate act. We're going to tell you a little bit more about the actual history, sort of how things change over time. But what I think is just worth knowing as you're listening to that is that the word abortion was not being used to describe a deliberate act until very, very rarely in the 18th century. And then it became much more common actually in the 1960s. And then also to understand that when people were talking about a deliberate act in those earlier times, they weren't talking about abortion as we tend to know it of like someone who's, you know, maybe 7 or 8 weeks pregnant. They were talking about, you know, someone who was could feel their baby moving inside of them already. And they had different language for that. So, Sarah, will you give us just kind of a quick overview? Because this is more your area.
Sure.
When's the first time it was used in English? When did that meaning start to change?
So abortion is a medical term derived from the Latin word that means to miscarry, right?
Yep.
So when we talk about the Latin versus the English, that means Latin is a lot older. So it was probably occurring a good bit before this first English mention.
Right. So we know that the first English mention of the word abortion synonymously with miscarry is in 1547. But we also know that it was being used synonymously for we have no idea how long before that, because it was being used in Latin in a direct correlation way, abortion equals miscarriage.
Yes. And it also didn't carry the moral implications that it carries today.
Okay.
So many people in history basically attached it to the idea that a fetus was expelled from the woman's body.
Yes.
Right? There was no, you did anything wrong, you induced anything. It was a term that had no negative connotations attached to it.
Yes. And interestingly, even from like the 19th century, so we're talking 150 years ago
not
here.
Very long.
Not all that long ago in some ways, and so long ago in others, right? Abortion as being something that was, okay, this isn't actually about abortion. This is about life. In the Catholic Church, human life was not believed to exist in a pregnancy until a woman could feel her baby kicking, what they called quickening.
Around the
20th week or so. For some people, it's a little earlier, a little later. But that was like their definition of when a fetus became a person. And so not only did the word abortion specifically refer to miscarriage, but when it was used during that time to talk about intentional termination, it was talking about much later term than we have had in the U.S. in a very long time. So that's also really fascinating. And even then, there are a few tiny references that you can find conflating the terms, but like 99.9% of the time, at that point, an intentional termination would have been feticide. At
not
this
abortion.
Much later gestational age, an abortion would have been miscarriage. Yeah.
Right.
And it really pretty much stayed that way until the 60s and 70s. And then, like, I mean, obviously, what's happening in the 60s and 70s?
First wave feminism.
First wave feminism. We got all the feminist movement happening. Can I just tell you guys, quick side note, bra burning was never actually a thing that we have any proven record of anyone doing during the 60s and 70s feminist movement. So I don't know where that came from, but that's just a tidbit I wanted to throw in here for you. So, all right. So this is when things really start to transform. And I think it's important for us to understand how quickly that transformation has happened over historical time. Because if we're trying to envision this on a timeline, we have 1500s and actually much earlier because of Latin. We just don't know when. So let's say 1100s, just to be generous, to 1960s, where this was a medical word. It wasn't stigmatized. There was no ideology or religion around it. It was not a moral thing. It was just a medical term, right? And then one thing, you know, we tell you when we get information about the English language, we're pulling it from the Oxford English Dictionary. Well, one thing that's super cool that they do is they create graphs where you can visualize and actually see visually. And, you know, we'll even pop them into the show notes for this episode over time, where you can see where the word jumps up in its use in print writing. And so we go from like not being used that much because it's in medicine and only so much is being written about medicine and about pregnancy loss, to all of a sudden this giant, giant leap that occurs between 1960 and 1970. And it has been on the rise literally ever since.
Yeah, for the 60s and 70s, that data visualization culminates in, of course, 1973 with Roe v. Wade.
Exactly.
Right? And then you can see some ebbs and flows.
Some ebbs and flows, but they're not drastic.
Not nearly as drastic.
The original line up from 1960 to 1970 is like this huge jump. It's like Mount Everest. And then the others are some of those smaller, beautiful mountains that are around. I don't know if Mount Everest has mountains around it. I assume it's in the mountain range, and it does.
Makes sense. Right?
You know, when you're in the mountains, you see lots of mountains. So that the ebbs and flows look more like that. They're never going back down to the valley. After the 60s, those conversations about abortion, they don't go back down. And this is because we've started talking about it politically,
as a moral term,
religiously,
right,
as a feminist act, as a revolution against a feminist act, of all the different ways. And then the next huge spike that we see kind of a slow rise over the years. The next huge spike that we see is between March and June of 2022.
What was happening then?
The overturn of Roe v. Wade. So those two rulings are the major spikes that we see. And with the exception of June of 2022, that was the time in history when the word abortion has been used the most in the history of the English language. But even excluding that, over the past 5 years or so, we have seen the use of this word in print more frequently than ever before at any other time in history. And I think that's what brings us to this issue where people are talking and talking and talking and talking, and it just feels like nobody's listening. You know, we talked about in an earlier episode, when you're trying to support someone through grief, through infertility, through miscarriage, instead of saying things to them, maybe we should just listen. And looking at these graphs, it becomes abundantly clear that we're not doing that. We're just talking. And so that's really what we wanted this episode to be. Yes, we're talking, but we're talking in this matter of fact, very researched, very informational and educational way, in hopes that maybe for a minute we can all just listen. And we can still go back and think about our own biases and our own beliefs, but in the context of understanding the history of this word a little bit better. And so then, of course, there's the struggle. What the heck do we do about it, right?
I think maybe we need to understand a little bit of what the problem is, right?
What the problem is.
Why is it so important that we don't conflate the medical term abortion, to lose a fetus, mm-hmm. right, with this sort of highly politicized, deeply moralized issue of terminating a pregnancy?
Yes.
By choice.
Yes.
Right? So what happens when those, you know, when that graph,
yes.
you know, finally hit that peak and everything sort of pounded together? Why is that such a bad
thing? It's such a bad, why is that such a bad thing? What's the problem? And I think there are two main problems here. And I would love to get more into each of these in future episodes. We talk about them on social media already. We talk about them on our website already. But for the sake of wrapping this up, we're going to kind of keep these short. I think the two main problems are that, number one, it creates, we have created a world where the experience that a woman has, actually, you know what? It's just one main point for two different audiences. It's the same point, though. We're creating a world where what happens inside a doctor's office is impacted by what's happening outside and people who don't necessarily understand the impact. So that could mean quite a few things, right? It could mean that you're me and that you are having your heart ripped out of your chest because you're being called a habitual aborter and you wanted these pregnancies and you know that that's not what the word means, but that's still what the word has been made to mean. And so how do I feel okay about that? And that's such a huge struggle. Or it could mean that you and your doctor are in a situation where you're having to make really, really, really hard decisions together that could impact your life. It could impact your health. It can impact so many things. And again, the outside world is potentially impacting what the patient is able to experience, how she feels about what she's experienced, and the care that the doctor is trying to provide.
So you're asking for kind of a separation of church and state here.
I think we have to have a different word. I think that's the ultimate thing that has to happen here. And what I want to say, because I'm the history nerd who loves words, is I want to say, can we just make abortion the medical term and can we come up with something else for elective termination? And then can we talk about them in clear, distinct, differentiated ways so that doctors understand where their boundaries lie and patients understand what's what and we can have clearer conversations? But the reality is language changes over time and we cannot undo 50 years worth of ever increasing placing meaning on top of this medical word. And so I think what we have to then do is push for a change in medical language. And I think it's honestly, it's more on the medical practitioners than it is on you and me to propose what those words should be, because they have the better impact of where their ability to care for their patients in the way they see best is being impacted. So I have ideas in my head. You know, I think, well, we could use the word pregnancy loss. But even that is going to be vague. Even that is going to leave certain things open. And so I think what we really need is for the medical community, particularly the obstetrical medical community, obstetricians, maternal fetal medicine specialists, those people to come together and say, how can we create a language and what would that lexicon look like where you and I can understand as we're transferring patients between people exactly what's going on in ways that are empathetic and that are in line with what the patient is experiencing emotionally and physically, but that also can then let us take these abortion debates that we're having and know where the separation is from the healthcare that the doctors need to provide and that so many women desperately need.
So do you think that if you had seen, you know, recurrent pregnancy loss on your chart instead of habitual aborter, and habitual, we haven't even talked about that.
Habitual,
so
right?
So casual.
Oh,
right?
My God.
Do you think that would have helped?
I would not be having this podcast episode today. When I say it's been 8 years and I still don't have the words, it's been 8 years and I still don't have the words. That would not have happened. The impact would have been, oh, now I get to get my test results. And I don't know if that's true for everyone, but for me, it would have made all the difference. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Undefining Motherhood podcast. It's been an honor to share this time with you. Remember, you're not just a listener, you're an essential part of our community. If today's conversation resonated with you, I have three simple requests for how you can help us grow. First, subscribe wherever you listened so you don't miss an episode. Second, we'd love it if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast, as that's one of the most important ways we can grow and share our message and community. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. Jump over to Instagram and find us at Undefining Motherhood, where you'll see a post about this week's episode where we can continue the conversation. Thank you for being a part of the Undefining Motherhood community, where together, we're making change. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.